The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com. For more than a decade, he's been your destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Chris, good morning. Love your show. You and Eddie are the dynamic duo.
I have a very hard time finding any news talk that I can trust, so I'm very grateful to have this listen to on the way to work.
Look, there is no federal solution. This gets solved at a state level. Look, there is no federal solution. This gets solved at a state level.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Good morning. Good morning, Philadelphia. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle, sitting across from the equally great Eddie Caiazzo. I am really happy, as I always am, thrilled to be behind the microphone, to have the privilege of being asked to sit in for really the greatest voice in the Delaware Valley, Radio Gold, and that would be Chris DeGaulle. And I will be with you today and tomorrow. And I was going to say pleased as punch. That sounds like something from 1912, but I was rereading my old Laura Ingalls Wilder books a little while back. You know, when you have a little bit of free time over the holidays, you do the things that you haven't had an opportunity to do in a while. So I was reading Anne of Green Gables and Laura Ingalls Wilder, you know, all that racy stuff. Hi, Eddie. How are you?
Good morning, Christine. Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas. You know, I posted on social media on Sunday. I was home. I was in Delco, and I was just walking around my sweet little neighborhood, looking at the Christmas lights, and I was walking along Darby Road, and an elderly gentleman who was on a cane. He was approaching me from the other direction. And you know how sometimes you avert your eyes when you see someone coming? It's sort of a normal thing to do in this day and age. Like, oh, we're all strangers. I don't want to see this person. But I looked at him and I smiled. And he looked at me and he smiled back. And he said, Merry Christmas. And I don't mean this to be a Hallmark Hall of Fame special kind of moment, but I got a little bit of a lump in my throat because it's kind of rare in this day and age with this tribalism that we seem to be having for just these random moments of grace where a stranger will say, Merry Christmas, didn't say hi, it was Merry Christmas. And I smiled back at him and I posted something about that on Twitter, just, you know, random throwaway thought, how nice it was to have a stranger hobbling on a cane, sure, say Merry Christmas to you. And it got so many likes, which I don't usually get a lot of likes on my tweets. And people are like, yeah, read her, move on. But this got a lot. And it actually got retweeted a bunch of times as well. And I think that that's because, you know, not to sound saccharine, but I've been sort of ruminating on the fact that we really have become so tribal in this country in the last couple of years. And I tend to blame the people who are not in my tribe, who happen to be on the left. I think that and I think I can be very clear eyed and in stating that a lot of this really has been generated by people on the left who have become incredibly intolerant of dissent or of those with different points of view. Not to say that it doesn't happen from, you know, my tribe, my family, my DNA, the conservatives, we do it too. But I think a lot of it has been generated from the left toward the right. or what they perceive as being the right. So when I find these moments of grace, it's exceptional. And it really, and I think, you know, the reaction to that tweet in my small area of influence, I'm an influencer with 4,000 Twitter followers, which, you know, it's like Kim Kardashian would be laughing to the bank. But in my small circle, that really got a reaction. So, you know, anyway. And I was listening this morning on my way over to the studio to a podcast with Marcus Luttrell. And anyone who's been listening to talk radio over the last decade, 15 years, knows the name of Marcus Luttrell. He wrote the book Lone Survivor. He was in Afghanistan and was ambushed by Taliban. And he was the only one of his group of, I believe, four was it Navy SEALs? Oh, God, Delta Force. I don't even remember right now. It's too early in the morning. But he was the only – he was the lone survivor of that group. And he had been speaking to someone around the time of the Afghanistan debacle this past year with the drawdown when we were leaving. And they were asking him about his opinion of that. But he said something really – which – really touched me. He said, you know, I was in a country where if they didn't like you, if they didn't agree with you, if they looked you in the eye and thought you weren't one of them, they'd shoot you through the heart or they'd cut your head off. And he said, it gives you a lot of perspective when you come home to the United States and you see that there's a lot of political animus and hatred and social animus and social hatred and hostility. And he said, still, you're home. When you're here in the United States, and he wasn't talking about criminality, he wasn't talking about, you know, random acts of violence. He was talking about political animus and the divisions that we have, partisanship, what have you. He said, at the end of the day, phrase that I hate, we are still all Americans, and we have to remember that. And it gets getting more and more difficult to remember that, particularly with the messaging that we're getting from the White House right now. But the average American doesn't want to shoot you through the heart. And the average American, if you disagree with them on a political position, doesn't want to cut your head off. That's not how we're wired. That's not who we are. So, you know, for the next 2 days, I am going to be talking about a lot of things that divide us. And I am on very distinctly on one side of the aisle on 99% of the issues that we're going to talk about. But I think it's good to out of the gate to sort of really put in perspective and context where we are here. We are Americans, all of us. And it would be nice if at some level and some point we could get back to that post, that 9/12, that post 9/11 feeling that we had, that, you know, regardless of what we look like and what churches or what houses of worship we frequent, that at heart we're all the same. So, yeah, I did read a lot of Laura Ingalls Wilder and Anne of Green Gables, Eddie.
I think it's what you're saying is very important. This audience knows for sure that I have a lot of, I mean, hey, living in Philadelphia, have a lot of leftist friends, a lot of leftist family members, a lot of leftism all around me. I can't really choose my congressman or city councilman or anything like that. But something that Chris said that's very important, and he said it to the Senate President Pro Tem, Jake Corman,
yeah,
when he interviewed him this year, who's now running for governor. You know, the problem I have is that they look at me as their political enemy. They look at their opposition as their political enemy. And for the first time in my life, whereas it used to be fun. Politics was not a game, but it was fun to bring up and talk about and rib each other over. Now it seems personal, so
yep.
I get what you're saying,
yep.
But I do view the Democrats, especially locally, yep. as enemies, And I'm not, and that's not personal toward anyone in my family or friend circle. That's not, mm-hmm. we can still have fun sometimes, but they are, to me, out to destroy and causing a lot of unnecessary harm. And they do not view me the same way that I once viewed them. Like, I just don't think they have that in their hearts. And that's not a blanket statement, not to say all. You've seen interactions on Twitter with me and some mm-hmm. some lefties, and we can all agree that Krasner sucks, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I for once, like, it really put it into perspective when I listened back to that interview with Chris and Jake Corman, and I think these people do not mean us well. They just don't. And I'm sorry. That's where I'm at right now.
No, and I think you speak for a lot of people. And at a very profound level, you speak for me as well, because a lot of this was unnecessary to begin with. Politics, as Chris said, politics was always fun, and it was always a game, and it was always strategic, and it was always, and at least for me, it was, well, it was kind of, I loved being argumentative. I love debating people.
Me too.
You know, I mean, well, you're yeah. Italian. I'm Italian. I'm part Irish. I'm trained as an attorney. These are things that we like to do, and you have, and it sometimes it's one-upsmanship. I want to win this debate. And sometimes it's a real genuine desire to persuade someone to sure. your point. Unfortunately, what's happened, and you said it really well, it's become personal. It's become blood sport. It's no longer something that we can say, well, it's politics, and then we put it aside, and then we go sit at the Thanksgiving table and we eat that disgusting marshmallow thing that people always pull out. It's like, why? But it unfortunately has devolved. So when I was listening to Marcus Luttrell and I was thinking about the larger picture of being an American, perhaps that was an aspirational thing. Perhaps that was me looking back to what I believe we once were and we could be again, you know, like the whole the once and future king. We could, that's something that we should aspire to. But right now, it is very difficult. And later in the show, you know, I'm really excited. We're going to have two really strong voices who are going to come in the 8 o'clock hour talking about the crisis in the city, with respect, the crisis in the area, in the you know, not just Philadelphia. It's bled over into my home area of Delaware County. In all of the suburban counties, you have crime, and a lot of that is attributable to Larry Krasner, but a lot of that is also attributable to the people who support him and the people who do nothing. And in a second, I'm going to talk about self-promoting my own column. But I do agree that it is becoming more and more difficult to sing Kumbaya and just say, okay, well, you know, your politics don't define you. Sadly, they do. We're going to take a quick break because I hear that pretty music, and we will be back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's 990 AM, The Answer. Wanted to sort of piggyback onto something that I had said earlier in the show. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle. Chris will be back on Friday, right, Eddie? We'll be back on Friday.
He's actually going to be back the next Tuesday.
Oh my goodness.
You for the next 2 days, me on Thursday, a best of on Friday and Monday, and then back in the saddle for the new year.
Oh,
January 4th,
wow.
I think. Yeah.
Oh, well, good. I'm glad Chris is having a nice vacation. Chris, we miss you. We absolutely miss you. But, you know, we know you'll be back soon. No, but I wanted to piggyback on something I said before about feeling that a lot of the animus is coming from one direction and heading in another direction, which would be, you know, how weather comes from the left and from the west and goes to the east. Well, it's from the left and it's going toward the right, the hostility here, the hostile winds. And just an example of this is an article that I saw in Politico yesterday where the women of The View, a show that I honestly may have seen all the way through when I had Dramamine with me three times in my entire life. And I've seen snippets of it over the years many times because it always gets replayed on CNN and MSNBC and sometimes on Fox and networks and anyway, what have you. Well, they're lamenting the fact that they just can't find that conservative token voice. And I mean, first of all, the whole idea that they have to look for a conservative on the at the table, you know, what do they have, five women, I think. So they've put aside, they have a quota for the conservative female voice, okay? You know, they have her in a corner somewhere. And they have a problem finding a conservative woman ever since Meghan McCain decided that she was going to step down. Meghan was not their first conservative. Was it Debbie Matenopoulos, I think, was sort of one of the – well, I don't know if she was a conservative, but she was one of the original on The View. And then what was the name? Elizabeth
– her last name, Hasselbeck?
Hasselbeck, thank you. Yeah, I remembered her husband was the quarterback, Matt Hasselbeck. She was there for a while. They had the governor of – the ex-governor of Utah, his daughter, Abby Huntsman, was on there for a while. Obviously, Meghan, I think, was the longest-running establishment conservative. And I know a lot of people probably listening to this audience would say, well, we don't think Meghan's a conservative. You know, 90% Meghan is a conservative. So – anyway, they were lamenting the fact that they couldn't find a conservative woman that sort of fit all of the metrics. And this is what they said. Sources close to the show said that the search has stalled as executives struggle to find a conservative cast member, with, you know, small c conservative, who checks all the right boxes. They will not consider a Republican who is a denier of the 2020 election results, embraced the January 6th riots, or is seen as flirting too heavily with fringe conspiracy theories or the MAGA wing of the GOP. But at the same time, the host must have credibility with mainstream Republicans, many of whom still support Donald Trump. And this is a quote, a direct quote from a from someone who did not want to have their identity revealed. The problem is that they bring people on under the mantle that this woman is a conservative when they're never Trump, so they don't represent the country, said one of the rotating guest hosts. And I think that that's actually true. The so-called conservatives that they have on that show are not what most conservatives would recognize as a conservative. And I said this yesterday on Twitter. I said they don't want a conservative. What they want is a pro-choice, never Trumper, mask embracing, Joe Manchin hating woman who sometimes eats red meat. I mean, that's it. They want someone who is basically them, but every now and then will tune into Fox for the weather report. You know, it's ridiculous what they what they imagine. They have no idea of what being a conservative woman in the United States means. So they should just give it up. Just stop even trying to find that so-called 20% balance that they want.
Yeah, I mean, because God forbid a woman, ready for this? God forbid a woman is pro-life.
That's not a real woman.
What do you do with that? If that woman comes on and she supports Trump, they want this person to connect to the MAGA wing of the party,
right?
Yet not support anything that the MAGA movement in the party stands for.
Right.
Okay. That seems very plausible.
Yeah, they're threading a needle that they will never be able to use in any tapestry that they are trying to create. Because it's you're right. They want a Frankenstein. Right. They want all these little pieces, and then they want to put it together. They want all these disparate pieces of a person and put it together and say, you know, here is your conservative creature creation.
Like Meghan McCain only checked one of the boxes. She had a hate for Trump, which, you know, notoriously Trump and McCain feuded.
Right.
They didn't like each other.
Right.
Perfectly fine.
Listen, I would do that if somebody came after my dad, sure. You know, the witch, I'd hate him. I don't care. I totally, completely supported her. I didn't, you know, I had no problem with that.
But God forbid she's a conservative woman, though, otherwise.
So that
was probably the end. It's just like, hey, Meghan, you're not for these lockdowns and masking. Well, the people that watch the show are, so shut up.
She was forthrightly pro-life. She yep. was. And, you know, the irony here that we're talking about Meghan being against Donald Trump, mm-hmm. which she was, you know, she was. I mean, I don't know if you could call her a never Trumper. She hated Trump, the man, but she didn't hate all of his policies. I heard her sometimes actually support some of the things that he was doing, including some of his immigration policies.
Yeah.
But she wasn't one of those people like me. I am not one of those people. I mean, I would be hated by, you know, 95% of the people who are hardcore. We love Donald Trump all, you know, over the cliff. You know, that's why I'll probably be not back tomorrow. But
no, joking.
No, the whole idea being, you know, but I recognize that the man did some exceptional great things for the country. I think Meghan recognized that as well, including recently, and I'm sure you're aware of this, her feud with Candace Owens, because Candace had an interview with Trump and they got on the whole topic of the vaccines. And Trump, to his credit, because he was the driving force behind Operation Warp Speed, which yes. conservatives seem to – they're between a rock and a hard place here. So a lot of conservatives who don't like the vaccine or vaccine mandates or what have you – and I agree. I'm against vaccine mandates. But a lot of people who don't like the vaccines, they don't want to acknowledge the fact that some of these vaccines work, and the reason that we have them is because of Donald Trump. So they're kind of like, oh, well, you know what? I love Donald Trump. I hate the vaccines. Donald Trump gave us the vaccines. I'm not going to talk about it. So, and Candace had this conversation with Donald Trump where he said, yeah, I've had the booster. I've done this and yeah. I've done that. And Meghan tweets out. She goes, you know, Candace was, for the first time, I'm going to support Donald Trump and say yeah. Candace was schooled by Donald Trump. And then, of course, Candace comes back and she hits Meghan. And she does something which I thought was really kind of despicable. And a lot of people were criticizing me for criticizing Candace. But, you know, Candace talks about obese people. And golly gosh, let's see, what was she saying? You know, basically the subtext being, you're fat, Meghan, and that's why you're going to get sick. And I'm like, seriously, Candace? Seriously?
Oh, the media wars.
The media wars with conservative women.
Hey, it's Sebastian Gorka. Join me this afternoon at 3. Now, more on Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's 990 AM, The Answer. I'm here with Eddie Caiazzo. I wanted to address something that I know Chris has talked about this a lot on the radio. I know we've talked about this a lot when I've been here. I had hoped to have someone come on and talk about this with me. Unfortunately, the people that I reached out to felt uncomfortable coming on air. And I think that that's an example of what Eddie and I were talking about at the beginning of the hour. If you know, didn't catch it, it'll be on a podcast later on. But the fact that we are so polarized and tribal, and the fact that in fact, that the left has been quite hostile toward
any kind of pushback, dissent on their social policies. And one of those social policies happens to be the continued masking of children, the draconian restrictions that we've been putting on social contact, child to child, the now increasing insistence that vaccinations for children are not only safe but necessary. And I, as I said, I had reached out to a few people. No one felt comfortable coming on because of pushback that they had received in the past about their positions against masking, their positions at school board meetings. They've had a lot of repercussions in their private lives. I am fortunate in that I am not married, for a variety of reasons, but I am fortunate in that I'm not married and I don't have my own children. I mean, I do have kids that are close to me that I love very much, that I have pretty much erased from my social media profile because of the pushback that I get on certain things. But the thing that has really pushed me over the edge recently is a report by the Surgeon General of the United States, wherein he states, Dr. Vivek Murthy, or Murthy, I'm not really sure how his last name is pronounced, but on Sunday on television, on CNN, he came out very bluntly and very clearly, and he said that his office had issued a mental health advisory after they unveiled alarming figures that 1 in 5 young people have reported experiencing depression in the last year and a half. That only, now this sounds horrible to say only, but less than 790 children have lost their lives to COVID. Okay? Any life lost is tragic. And I know, you know, people say, oh, well, you have to say that. Of course you have to say that. Any life lost, particularly the life of a child lost to COVID, is devastating. However, there has been a stratospheric spike in suicides in children between the ages of 10 and 18. You tell me that forcing a child to wear a mask from 7:30 in the morning until 3:30 in the afternoon, yelling at them if they're not wearing it properly, suspending them if they're not wearing it properly, asking them in front of the class, in front of their classmates, if their parents have been vaccinated, mandating now that they not be allowed in school unless they're vaccinated. These are all things that are actually happening. These are all things that are not hypotheticals. You tell me that this hasn't had a direct impact on the rise in depression and in suicide. I mean, I speak from personal experience. I have a close family member who killed himself. He wasn't a child. So imagine a family suffering from a child who is so desperate, so lonely, so isolated, so unable to figure out how to make it through this forest of rules and random regulations and changing, restrictions and social pariah status, and adults, teachers, school board administrators telling them to do these things.
who can't do that and who in the most extreme cases take their lives and in the less extreme cases become depressed, need therapy. Or if they you know, don't even express these thoughts and internalize everything, become ticking time bombs that later on, when they're in college or in their early adult years, are going to see manifestations of what is being imposed on them by a society that doesn't know what the blank it is doing. I was a school teacher for 5 years, and thank God I taught in an era when I cared about the mental health of children as much as I cared about their physical health. In fact, I think given the statistics that less than 800, I mean, that was kind of a strange number, 790, less than 800 children since the start of this pandemic have lost their lives to COVID. And, you know, I would question those statistics as to whether or not COVID was the direct and main cause of their demise, or whether they had an underlying condition that, but for the COVID, they would have died anyway, but that COVID simply hastened their deaths. I mean, that is. And you're going to – maybe you'll think that I'm being Mengelean in making these mathematic calculi here. But when you're talking about thousands upon thousands upon thousands of diagnosed cases of clinical depression and hundreds of suicides over the past 2 years in children who never before exhibited any kind of mental, emotional issues, debilitating issues. When you talk about that and you weigh one statistic against the other, don't you think — it's a rhetorical question because I know what the answer is — but don't you think that the focus on masking, on the transmission of an illness which is not killing children, is just absolutely unsupported and unacceptable? The true epidemic is a mental health epidemic. And none other than the Surgeon General of President Joe Biden, Vivek Murthy, confirmed it for us. This is Christine Flowers, Philadelphia's 990 AM. The Answer. We'll be back. Please don't cry no tears now. It's Christmas, baby. My snowman and me.
Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. This is Dennis Prager, middays 1 to 3. Grab a cup of coffee for the ride in. You're listening to Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle.
Welcome back. So to follow up on what we were discussing before about children and masking, and you know, and it almost seems that all I've talked about for months and months is children and masking, and people are like, oh my God, get over it, move beyond it. There are other things that are happening in the world, but I really do think that this is important because it may seem like a small thing to some people. Oh, just put that piece of fabric over your child's face and shut up about it. But it's an example of something larger, and it's an issue of control. It's an issue of someone who is outside of your family, someone who presumes to know what's best for you, and who basically has a veto power over your understanding of what's best for your child, telling you you're going to do this. And then when it comes out statistically that what they are telling you to do to your child is actually harming your child, they will completely pivot and say, well, don't tell us, you know, we're the experts. We know what's best. And you're a conspiracy theorist. And you believe in satanic rituals and all of the, you know, it is amazing the pushback you get when you criticize the necessity for masking. And vaccines are a whole other topic and subject. I wanted to focus on the masking because I think that that's sort of the low-hanging fruit here. I think we can all agree that after 2 years of wrapping our children, mummifying our children, making sure that they don't see the bottom of their friends' faces, that it hasn't done anything appreciable to stop the spread of the disease, of the virus, among children who, by the way, again, and this is not spreading misinformation, so I won't be suspended from Twitter and I won't be kicked off of Facebook. This is not misinformation. The vast, vast, vast majority of children who contract COVID do not get sick. And if they do get sick, they get the equivalent of a cold. Okay, less than 790 children have been casualties because of COVID. And you want to measure that against the millions of people who have actually died from COVID? I'm thinking that that's a pretty insignificant statistical number. But you know, be that as it may, no one ever wants to say that, well, 790 souls were expendable. Not one child is expendable. Every child is precious. And I would hope that the people who believe that masking is necessary and that every child is precious and that every life is precious are also anti-abortion. Yeah, I know that's not the case.
Yeah, I saw a tweet from Josh Shapiro, I think it was yesterday, saying like I will stand for everyone in your family. And I was in some Twitter fight, so I ignored it. But I'm thinking, like, except for the unborn one, right? Except for a child, that you stand for the family. But you know, just let's be clear here. Let's not mince words. You stand for everyone except a baby.
Shapiro is a I regularly retweet and mock his tweets because they're pathetic. They really are really ridiculous. They're canned pieces of propaganda right out of the Pravda playbook. I will fight for a woman's right to bodily integrity. Unless that woman doesn't want to take a vaccine.
Right.
Right?
That's a good
You know,
point.
What about her bodily integrity? I was in a conversation yesterday, a Twitter conversation. It was actually fairly civil with a trans woman who was very, she was offended by the term biological female. And I said to her in the nicest way possible, I said, well, we're supposed to follow the science. I'm pro-life and I don't like the term fetus. I really don't. It seems very clinical and sterile to me for unborn baby, but I will bow to the science in the sense that that is what an unborn child scientifically is. It is a fetus, okay? I call it an unborn child because that's what I truly believe it to be, and that's what the science says
sure.
It is.
You're just
too.
Following the science, that's
right,
all.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'll accept the term, the biological term fetus. So why then are you offended by the biological term, biological female? Why am I forced to use fetus, but you don't want me to use biological female? You want me to call you a woman.
Right.
You're not a biological woman. You're someone who is an aspirational woman. You're someone who identifies as a woman. You think you're a woman. And go with God. God bless you. If you travel in circles that will accept you as a woman, be happy. Like I said, go with God.
Sure.
Who made you a man, but I didn't say that part.
No, but that's the thing. It's like you do you. Just don't have this expectation of me or for, you know, in the case of this University of Penn, the transgender swimmer.
Oh!
It's like, okay, I understand you identify as a woman, but the problem is that you're not. Like, so you're breaking all these records by these astronomical numbers. It's just like, because you're not a woman, but don't hate me for saying that you're not. I'm just saying, I'm just following the science. This is not, it's not transphobic. I don't hate that person for them simply being transgender. It's just that in this situation, you're not a woman. That's why you're winning all these swimming records and, you know, and destroying the old records.
That's right. And I'm glad that there has been fairly vocal pushback on that.
Yeah.
That there have been people, you know, and granted, the young women, the females, the actual biological female swimmers at Penn, the ones who were complaining, a number of them didn't want to give their names because they felt uncomfortable. You know, because of the pushback, you know, the societal shaming. But at least they spoke out.
It's Mike Gallagher. Join me this morning at 9 on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Now let's get you back to Philadelphia's Morning Answer with the great Chris DeGaulle.
So, we made it through the first hour, Eddie. I can't believe it. You and me shooting the breeze. We've got a great 2 hours still to come. In the next hour, at the end of it, we're going to have the great George Bacchetto on. We'll talk about a bunch of stuff with George. And then in the 8 o'clock hour, as I said, I have two powerhouse guests that are going to be talking about crime. Speaking of crime, Eddie, you mentioned, I think the actual number of homicides in Philly is 549 with a bunch of suspicious deaths.
Yes.
My question is, I wonder how many of those people were wearing masks. Masks could have prevented those deaths.
They really could have.
You know?
The masks and the vaccine.
It's just amazing. We will be back, guys, in a short bit.
This is WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
You are a role model for the rest of the media. You really do investigative reporting and informative interviews.
I absolutely love your show.
Chris, greetings from the bright lights of Cherry Hill.
We don't have time to be wasting on these phony, trumped-up culture wars. This fake outrage that the right-wing media is peddles to juice their ratings. And the fact that he's willing...
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle, sitting here with Eddie Caiazzo on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. And I am thrilled to be here. That was a very quick first hour, Eddie. As usual, it just, you know, I come in here and I think, what am I going to talk about? What am I going to talk about? What am I going to talk about? 3 hours. What am I going to talk about? And then it's, I'm already realizing I don't have enough time to talk about everything that I want to talk about. So, I mean, I guess that's the sign. I guess that's a good sign, right? It's a lot better than sitting here with dead air.
Well, I don't know, because it's funny. Chris is always, I mean, since he's been in Philadelphia, he's always been off the week between Christmas and New Year's. Like, just that's always the way it's been. And he said since Trump's been elected in 2016, like, usually when you went into the holidays, the reason he's off that week is because there was nothing, no breaking news. No, the Congress is quiet, local government quiet, everything. Everyone's just kind of waiting until the calendar turns over. That's not the case anymore. He's just like, I feel like if I'm out, like five things break. So yeah, there isn't enough time in a day to talk about every single thing that's happening right now because there's so much.
Exactly. I mean, I have this with, and you've done some amazing work. By the way, audience, I want you to know Eddie Caiazzo, he's not only a fabulous producer, he's not only a fantastic on-air personality, he's a really great photocopier because I have a ream of articles over here and they're great articles and I will not be able to touch on every single article that I have over here. But, you know, in the 8 o'clock hour, as I said, we are going to be talking about crime. And very, very briefly, I just want to touch on something that will very likely be echoed in the 8 o'clock hour. And that's what recently happened to my congressional representative, Mary Gay Scanlon, who, as you all know, was the victim of a carjacking about less than a mile from my office in South Philadelphia at FDR Park, or what the locals there call the Lakes. FDR Park is not a traditionally dangerous area. I learned how to drive there at the age of 40. Not well, which is why I'm not really driving right now. But I learned how to drive there. It's a very, you know, bucolic. They had the flower show there this year. At night, it could be a little sketchy. Anytime you go to an inner city park at night, you have to be a little bit careful. But she was carjacked at, I believe it was 2:45 in the afternoon. Okay. The shank of the day, the afternoon. It was light outside. And this, I don't know how many guys, I think there were two guys, came up to her with a gun, pointed the gun at her, got her keys, took her car. In the car, there was her laptop, her cell phone, you know, all of the things that a U.S. congressperson travels with. And, of course, they didn't know she was a U.S. congressperson. They did not know that Mary Gay Scanlon was a person of substance and importance. They just saw this lady with a really cool car, and they decided that they were going to take it. Well, big mistake, because you do know that carjacking, the offense can be a federal offense. And it is being charged by U.S. Attorney Jennifer Arbiter Williams, brilliant woman, huge fan of Counselor Williams. And she's charging this as a federal offense. And one of the offenders is 19. So he is an adult. And he's facing serious time. I think the other one, there's a younger one who's 13 and somebody else. I mean, you know, oh, I didn't mean to do it. I'm so sorry. Yeah. Well, all right. So we can talk about the aspects of the crime itself and the fact that there is crime in the city of Philadelphia. But I think the thing that really just fascinated so many of us, and trying to be sober here, and obviously we have to say at the outset that we are happy. We are legitimately happy that Mary Gay Scanlon is safe and that nothing happened to her, because you have to be a pretty sick human being to want someone to physically suffer just because you happen to disagree with them politically. And I disagree with Mary Gay Scanlon so profoundly. I voted against her twice. I am really unhappy that she's my congressional representative. I can't stand her policies, so to speak. But I am genuinely, genuinely happy that she was not a victim of crime, a victim like so many people in her constituency, both in Delaware County and in that small sliver of Philadelphia that makes up part of her district. The thing that so many people were quick to note was that Mary Gay Scanlon is one of those Democrats who called for defunding of the police. And yeah, I know that the Democrats are out there saying, well, we didn't really mean defund. That's not the word we should have used, but that's not what we really meant. We meant to reallocate resources to, you know, homeless advocates and social workers and mental health experts and all of that stuff. And my thought is, yeah, okay, well, did Mary Gay Scanlon call a social worker? Did she call a mental health expert to help track her car? Was she consulting with a homeless advocate to see how she could get her property back? And, oh, yeah, does she feel safer that there would be social workers, homeless advocates, and mental health experts protecting her from gun-wielding thugs? Okay.
Did she dial 911 first, or did she go to those other places first? That's my question. Go ahead.
Well, I'm sure that maybe she didn't. Maybe her people did. You know,
right.
Her posse, the people that she travels with. Because I mean, if you're a congressional, if you're a congresswoman, I mean, you have people, Eddie. You travel with people.
VIP.
Exactly. Very important princess. I mean, person. Excuse me. But this is what she tweeted in the wake of the George Floyd riots. Oh, I'm sorry. Social justice protests. Where was it? Oh, my gosh. I lost it. No, she tweeted. Yeah. She tweeted, "We have seen too many lives taken and too many communities devastated by police brutality and racial profiling. Action is long overdue. House Democrats are fighting for real, capital R-E-A-L, reform in our country's policing departments. Hashtag justice in policing." I wrote a column in the Delaware Valley Journal, and I said that this is typical passive-aggressive. This is a typical passive-aggressive tweet of someone who isn't explicitly calling the police racist, but who's pretty much following the script of police bad, communities of color sad. And it just, you cannot help the schadenfreude. You cannot help feeling at some level just the idea that this is karmic. This is karmic. A person who has actively undermined the police as a whole, tarring them with the brutality brush and implying, inferring that they're racist, that person then needs those same targets of her ire and abuse to protect her. Another thing that somewhat annoyed me, but that doesn't surprise me, is that very important people get very quick action. I mean, they found her carjackers, who really were kind of stupid because they held on to the car. Carjackers usually don't do that. They take it for a joyride, then they take it to a chop shop and, you know, sell it for pieces. But no, these idiots, these criminal, not masterminds, kept the car, which they found, I think it was in Delaware. So, I forget what my point was, but, you know, but the whole idea that she was someone who wanted the police to be defunded, then benefits from their great crackerjack work. And if you were Joe Schmo or Eddie Caiazzo or Christine Flowers, you'd still be looking for your frickin' car. And you might not have come away unscathed from this incident. So it is troubling that we do have somewhat of a caste system in the United States as well. That, you know, important people get important treatment. We're going to take a quick break because they're important people you have to listen to. This is Christine Flowers on Philadelphia's 990 AM, The Answer.
On this holy Christmas Day, I'm so thankful I can say, now the jingle hop has begun. Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell twist. Jingle bells chime in jingle bell time. Dancing and prancing in Jingle Bell Square.
Welcome back.
In the frosty
air. This is Christine Flowers, sitting in for Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. So, a story caught my attention. You know, I'm a lifelong Philadelphian. I was born in Baltimore, as you all know. Spent 3 months there, and then my family took me back to Philadelphia, where they were from originally. Grew up, spent 10 years, first 10 years of my life in Logan, and we moved out to Delaware County. But I spent 90% of my time in the city, even when I was, you know, living in Delaware County. So I'm from this area. I know the customs, and I know the differences between the neighborhoods. I have a real feeling for the city, and I know you do too, Eddie. And I've been working in South Philly for the last, since 1995, so what's that, 1996, that's 20, it'll be 26 years in about a week. So there's something in South Philly, not just South Philly, but I would say it's predominantly in South Philly. It's called Savesies, and it's where people either put out a little orange cone or a chair, usually a cone now. Used to be chairs, something to save a parking spot, because parking is at a premium in the city, and particularly in South Philadelphia. And if you've been down in South Philadelphia, you know how packed it is. That's why the parking authority and the police have basically just thrown up their hands about policing parking in the middle of Broad Street. I mean, you know, if you're not from Philadelphia and you come and you see this long line of cars that go from Broad and wherever it is, Broad and Oregon, all the way up to, I think it's like Broad and not Mifflin, even beyond that, where people will park in the center of Broad Street. And you're not supposed to do that. But the police aren't enforcing that, because it's like trying to empty the Atlantic with a teaspoon, because South Philly people are going to go back and they're going to park there. And you're going to ticket them? Fine. They're just going to forget about the tickets. I mean, they're going to park there. Same thing with Savesies. You're going to save a spot, especially in the winter when it snows and what have you. And I'm not supporting necessarily that tradition, because it is illegal. I mean, it should be first come, first serve. You don't own that spot in front of your house, or you don't own that little piece of property next to the curb. It's not yours. It belongs to the city. But it's a city tradition, okay? It's like the Wanamaker's light show, okay? It's like soft pretzels, okay? Well, recently, a group of people online have gathered together. They call themselves the Cone Rangers, and they have been taking pictures of cones in spots where they shouldn't be, and they're removing the cones, and they are policing. They're doing their own parking authority shtick. They're policing it themselves, okay? That's not the problem. The problem is they're making this big deal about it on social media about how we're taking the streets back.
Sure.
Now, 9 out of 10 of these people are carpetbaggers. They are not native Philadelphians. They are people who came from other places, including the suburbs. They are what I call the baristas from Bella Vista. And as I said on Twitter, I said, the police are not going to come when the barista from Bella Vista is beaten up by Granny from 10th and Shunk, because South Philadelphians know how to protect their property. And if you try and undo their savesy, you're going to be in trouble, as Mara Fitzpatrick found out when she and her husband, they found, supposedly in this story on Philly Voice, they only found one parking spot. I don't believe that. there are other parking spots, but this probably was closest to their little condo. And so Mara and her husband took a cone, moved it to the side, parked in the spot. The next morning, Mara gets to the car, and there's a threatening note on the windshield. Don't do this. We'll get you the next time. Undeterred, Mara does it again and suffered $700 worth of damage to her car. Called the police, and the police basically said to her, call us next time. We'll move it for you. The car and the cone. Because the police also know. And again, I am not supporting vigilantism. I am not saying it's a good idea to attack someone's car simply because they wanted to park in a certain spot. I am saying, be wise, people. You're not from this area. You don't understand. You call yourself a cone ranger? You have no idea about the innate culture of not just South Philly, but of Philadelphia proper. And that's really important. And with the violence in the city today and the trigger mentality that people have, don't take a person's orange cone because you might end up on the wrong side of a statistic. Let's go to the phones because we have someone who is a native of South Philadelphia and maybe she can weigh in on this whole savesies issue. Hey, Gloria from South Philly, how are you?
Hi, how are you? I'm fine, thank you. You're doing a great job so far.
Thank you. What do you think about savesies, Gloria?
About safety?
Savesies. Have you listened to what I was just talking about?
Oh, yes. About the parking issue? Please.
So what do you think about that? I mean, you're a South Philly legend. You've been there. I mean, and by the way, those of you who are listening, if you have access to the South Philly Review, you really need to pick it up on a weekly basis because Gloria always has something beautifully written in there. But you're perfect for this because you're from South Philly. You grew up there. You understand the whole idea of putting a lawn chair or an orange cone to save parking spot. And I know you're not supposed to do that. It violates parking authority, regulations, but it's also a tradition. And it's something as much of a tradition as parking in the center of Broad Street because parking is at a premium. So as I was saying, there's this whole group of younger people now who've decided that they're going to take the parking issue into their own hands, remove the cones, and they're getting threatened by people who have lost their parking spaces.
Okay. What would you do? I understand exactly what you're saying because it's the rule that you're not supposed to save spaces. You know what people do to save space? They get themselves handicap signs.
Right.
I know people have done it. Really.
Yeah.
And they use, and because that kind of reserves the spot for their car because you have to have a handicapped license plate. So that's one of the ways people get around it. They find a doctor to sign a paper, and then they get a politician to sign more papers, and they get the signs. But anyone who has that license plate, that same license, can park in their spot. But nobody dares to do that. But anyway, I understand. In fact, yesterday there was a neighbor two doors away who used chairs to hold a spot for their car. But the neighbor was standing out guarding it at the same time.
Yeah, it's almost like it's like I think of those old pioneer settlers who used to stand in front of their property with guns, with the marauding, the native Indians, Native Americans, whatever.
She didn't have a weapon, but she was staring at the spot the whole time.
Then the
car did come back and they moved the chairs. It's a common thing to put cones but it's also risky. And you're right. Those people who come along and see those cones and move them, they're legally correct.
They are. And thanks for the call. It's great, Gloria, to talk to you. They are legally correct, but they're really practically stupid.
Hey, take us with you on your phone. Download our free mobile app now at 990theanswer.com.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Well, I am thrilled, as always, when I get an opportunity to be behind the microphone to have on as a guest someone that I personally admire, that I consider a friend, but who to whom I have always looked as an example of the best that the Philadelphia legal community has to offer. And that's saying a lot, because Philadelphia has produced some of the finest attorneys in the history of this country, including the greatest Philadelphia attorney, and that's Andrew Hamilton. So Google him. Not Alexander, not the guy with the rap Broadway show, Andrew Hamilton, the one who basically, before the First Amendment even existed, he defined the limits of free speech and freedom of assembly. And I think of my next guest, George Becchetto, in that same spirit, because George has done some amazing work on behalf of freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, freedom of thought, fighting against censorship, random intolerance and hostility. And so I am thrilled to welcome George Becchetto onto the show. Hi, George. Merry Christmas and an anticipatory Happy New Year.
Well, good morning. I certainly hope I can live up to that introduction. That's that's wonderful, Christine. How are you? And best wishes always.
Well, you've already lived up to it. Sorry, you've in all the work that you've done in your lifetime, but with recently, and something near and dear to my own heart, your work with Columbus Day and the Columbus statue, and your work in. I think the work that you've done is particularly notable with respect to Italian-American pride, because we talk about tolerance in this society and multiculturalism and, you know, identity being so important, and except when it comes to certain identities that are uncomfortable. And I want you to speak to it. I don't want to be the one yapping my lips over here. But what you have done to be really advance and protect and preserve the dignity of the Italian American community in Philadelphia and nationwide, as it turns out, with federal lawsuits, is just exemplary at a time when it's not the cool thing to defend, so-called white groups. And I remember growing up when my grandparents were telling me that Italians weren't always considered white. They were considered sort of others. They were different. They were a different group of people. But unfortunately, we're the establishment now. And so it's okay for Mayor Kenney to go after us because we're not indigenous and we don't bring anything to his multicultural mix. So I really wanted to ask you right now, what is the status? I know you guys were going to be taking depositions of the city. What's the current status of the litigation with respect to the statue, which I know is still in a box because I see it every day when I drive down on Broad Street?
Yeah, the current status is pretty complicated, actually. There are a number of different rulings that came out of the Court of Common Pleas in Philadelphia, all of them in our favor. One of the rulings was that the attempt to remove the statute was completely illegal and the statute must stay. That's been appealed by the city to the Commonwealth Court. City has a right to an appeal. There's no question about that. We have the right to defend against that appeal and to call it what it is, which is completely frivolous. Now, there's a second order that the judge issued, and by the judge, I'm referring to Judge Paula Patrick, that permitted us to immediately remove the box. And when I went there that Saturday morning on Columbus Day weekend, October 9th, to enforce that order, I was met by 25 policemen who told me they were under specific words from the mayor to stop me from removing the box, even though I had a court order that said I was perfectly lawfully doing so. And they physically prevented me and my contractor from getting near the box to remove it. The city took a separate appeal from Judge Patrick's order on the removal of the box, and the Commonwealth Court later that day said, all right, time out. We're not going to remove the box until we have a chance to review the underlying appeal that the city filed. Well, it's a totally different issue. And the Commonwealth Court, frankly, was just wrong about that. And we have appealed that denial to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. So the underlying appeal is in the Commonwealth Court, but we have an appeal on the removal of the box issue pending now in front of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. It's been briefed by both parties, all sides, and we're awaiting a ruling. Now, in the meantime, because Kenney and his administration obstructed justice in the manner which I just described, we also did some motions to take discovery. I want the deposition of Jim Kenney. I want the deposition of the police officers that were there, which, by the way, they were extremely professional in the way in which they handled themselves. And they basically said, George, look, what are we going to do? We're caught in the middle here. They were extremely professional. But the fact of the matter is they were acting under strict orders from the mayor to prevent me from carrying out that court order. Now, that's no legal obstruction of justice. So we're moving to take their depositions, and we've subpoenaed each of them. They're refusing to show up under advice from the city solicitor. So we now have yet another motion pending in front of the court to enforce the subpoenas and make them show up for the depositions. I know that's a very long answer to kind of a simple question of what's the status these days, George, but it's taken on this particular litigation because of the intransigence of the mayor and his refusal to act according to law. It's just taken on all of these different dimensions, and I'm not going to let up one little bit. He thinks he can outlast me. That's not going to happen. I'm going to outlast him, frankly. He's going to be out of office before I give up.
Well, first of all, bravo, standing ovation. Secondly, I'm glad you went through that whole process with which I am quite familiar. In fact, I was there the day that you got the order from Judge Patrick that allowed that ordered the removal of the box, the obstruction. We were all so very happy that had happened. And I agree with you, obviously, that what the mayor did is obstruction of justice. It was in direct violation of Judge Patrick's order. And it's taken on something more than this. Is not just about a statue. This is not just about naming a holiday. This is an administrator. This is a chief executive, the mayor and his administration, who are doubling down on their intolerance, hatred, and hostility of not only the Italian-American community, but more specifically, the Italian-American community of South Philadelphia. And it is a personal crusade on the part of this mayor. I'm not putting words in your mouth. This is me speaking right now. But I have spoken to many people who are, pardon the pun, indigenous to South Philadelphia. I'm not. I've been there for 26 years, having worked there that long. But I know a lot of people in that area, and they understand that Jim Kenney has some kind of animus toward the place where he was born and grew up and the people that surrounded him, nurtured him, helped him advance his career. So this is personal on his part, and he's misusing the laws of this Commonwealth and the city in order to advance a personal vendetta that he has. And he's doing it on the backs of Italian Americans. And I'm really glad that you're doing what you're doing, and your legal team and the people that are supporting you with the 1492 Association and a lot of the other organizations that have been supporting you. And I think it's really important that somebody stand up, push back, And maybe the next thing we can look at is the Rizzo statue, because that's something else that under the cover of darkness was removed with you know, no legal basis for this other than a bunch of loudmouth social justice, I don't even want to call them activists, rioters who had a problem with the mayor, a former mayor of the city of Philadelphia, who, by the way, Jim Kenney, didn't get along with particularly well. So that was another little personal vendetta he was able to get over. But I want to talk about you, well, George. Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Christine, you mentioned something that I think is really fascinating because it relates to the subject that you were just talking about before I jumped on. And that is, you know, you really have to understand South Philly to understand their parking situation and what's fair and what's not fair. And you really touched on it. You really have to understand where Jim Kenney came from and how he came up through the ranks to understand what his current animus is towards Italian Americans. Remember, Jim Kenney started out as Senator Fumo's gopher. Jim, we need coffee. Jimmy, did you throw out the garbage? Jimmy, yeah. Get the car and move it from here to there. And Jimmy Kenney, for decades, was Fumo's lackey. Well, what apparently must have been percolating was a deep-seated hatred for the kind of culture and structure that he was operating within. And he must have had a very deep-seated resentment for then-Senator Fumo. Because, as you know, Fumo's been very supportive and active on this Columbus statute. And the day you were there, Christine, Senator Fumo was also there, and he sat in a chair right next to the box and told the police, "I'm not moving."
I'll tell you, I have a great deal of respect for Senator Fumo.
But you got to understand, you have to understand, you know, that what you were suggesting earlier about some of these carpetbaggers that come in and try to tell Pennsylvanians how to run things.
They call them the baristas from Bella Vista.
I mean, you have to be there. I mean, it's just part of the landscape and part of what's fair in society. And when you have a person who turns into Jim Kenney, who turns into a veritable tyrant, you have to stand up to it. And you whether it's the Italian culture today or the Irish culture tomorrow, mm-hmm. or the Puerto Rican culture the day after that, whatever it is, you have to stand up to tyranny, because tyranny never works, never lasts. And it's not what we Americans, it's not the way we want to live.
No, and you make a great point about, you know, we there's always been that problem with the idea of gentrification, of people who are from the outside coming in and with their ideas thinking they're going to make a place better, based on what, their metrics and their value set. And a lot of times gentrification is used when you have white middle class individuals moving into historically black neighborhoods like in North Philly. But it also happens in places like South Philadelphia, where you have young college educated couples and they come in. And I see it all the time in South Philly, certain areas, the two couple, one baby, three dog family, and the lovely young family, but they've decided that they're going to completely change the culture of South Philadelphia. And to some extent, they're successful in certain pockets. And it would be fine if they were willing to live together with the people who actually built South Philadelphia. But a lot of them are not. A lot of them want to completely change that culture and disrespect the immigrants who were there before them and who created the South Philadelphia that they want to move into. And it's like what happened in my suburb in Delco. A lot of people fled Philadelphia because of the crime. We're going to be talking about that in the next segment. But then they recreate the policies and the regulations that helped create that crime in my district, in my area, in the suburbs. And it's frustrating when you see that people disrespect other people who came before them. George, I want to ask you, I was very happy to hear that you are mulling a run for the Senate on the GOP ticket. Is that true?
Yes, it is true. I've been studying the situation now for over a month, and really intensely studying it. Of course, I've always been interested in public service, and in years past have served the public in various ways. But I've been looking at this race very intensely for about a month now, and I've assembled a team of professionals that really get it, understand what it takes to win a United States Senate seat across the state of Pennsylvania. And we're very encouraged by what we see. We're very encouraged about what I believe are going to be the core values that are going to be most important in this upcoming election. I think the core values are going to be people that want to stand up for the rule of law, people that want to stand up and make sure that the principles, the fundamental principles that have made this country great, are going to be continued to be practiced, and that we finally have some common sense in some of our leadership. Just to give you a few examples, I mean, there really is no big debate on, or there should not be a big debate on, how many genders we have. We have two genders, male and female. Now, there could be transgender issues and that type of thing, but basically we have two genders. And until we come to grips with that and start to just accept nature and biology for what it is, we're going to be awfully confused about what to do. I'm not confused about what to do. I don't think most Pennsylvanians are confused about what to do. But I think that there are some people that are misthinking the issues that would like to confuse all of us. There's really very little debate about who are abusing guns. The guns are abused by criminals.
Right. Absolutely.
Solid, hardworking people don't have a gun problem. It's the criminals. And if we don't bear down on the criminals and treat them with the degree of accountability that they must have, then we're going to have all this lawlessness. The murder rate in Philadelphia and, frankly, across Pennsylvania isn't skyrocketing because wonderful, decent people are out there killing each other. It's criminals that are doing this. And you have to treat criminals as criminals.
Yeah,
and we need to remember these kinds of fundamental messages, or else we're gonna just lose it as a society.
I think, and unfortunately, we're up against the clock, but I know that Chris is going to have you on. And if I'm back on here again, I'm definitely going to have you on. And I'd love to write about you. I think you are... You have a clear voice. You have a strong voice. You have a forceful voice. You're not afraid to say you're not afraid to say things that should be obvious truths, but unfortunately in this society have become controversial. You're right. There are two genders. That's it. End of story. Criminals are the ones who are killing other people. Law abiding gun owners are not the ones who are killing other people. Children should not be wrapped in masks from nine to three in the afternoon. So many different things to talk about. Wish we had more time. George, I'm so grateful that you came on this morning. Thank you for all the work that you're doing, as they say in Italian, in bocca al lupo. And I will keep up with you, and we'll be in touch. Really appreciate it.
Great. Great, Christine. Always a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm delighted to be your guest.
God bless. Happy New Year. That was the great George Becchetto, and this is Christine Flowers on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
It's Dominic the Donkey, jingety-jing, the Italian Christmas donkey, la, 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 la.
This is Sebastian Gorka. Join me this afternoon at 3 on AM 990, The Answer.
So, in the next hour, I have two great guests coming on. They're going to be talking about the situation of crime in the city of Philadelphia, future of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I was glad to hear George Becchetto talk about him throwing his hat into the ring. The Pennsylvania Senate race is going to be a national event. It's going to be really, really important. And, you know, there's George, there's Lou Barletta with the GOP. There are a number of other individuals who've thrown their hats into the ring. And then, of course, there's John Fetterman on the Democrat side. So this is going to be a very, very interesting race. And I think we're all going to be, it's going to be fun to be, to have the national spotlight on Pennsylvania. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. This is Christine Flowers on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. A Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
I am a devoted listener every day, 3 hours, kids in the car, the whole thing.
Hey, good morning, Chris. I always love your show.
I just love your show. Just love it.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
We don't have a crisis of lawlessness. We don't have a crisis of crime. We don't have a crisis of violence. And that is a category that includes gun violence, but it also includes some pretty horrible stuff, like rape committed without a weapon, or like a stabbing.
Okay. All right. Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. So that was Larry Krasner. My column in the Delco Times yesterday was titled Krasner's Shame is Now a National Nightmare. I just want to read the last paragraph to you as a lead-in to our next guest. I wrote, Larry Krasner has at least another 4 years to push Philadelphia to the brink of anarchy, and the people who once embraced him, including those who continue to call the police pigs and vilify anyone who seeks actual justice for victims, can now pretend to be appalled. They can clutch their pearls around their tender necks all they want. We're the ones who are choking. It's too late for the Heimlich maneuver, and it's their fault. The point of that column was to call out people who are now coming out, like Michael Nutter and the Philadelphia Inquirer to some extent, and pointing fingers and saying, oh, my goodness, maybe, you know, maybe there's a problem. Maybe we were wrong. Too little, too late. Fortunately, there have been people who have been sounding the alarm for a good while. And one of them is my friend Ben Manis. And I'm very, very happy to have Ben here on the line with us. He's a great guest. He's a media contributor and subject matter expert in public safety and integrity. I mean, he walks the walk. He has a lot of experience in the field. He's a columnist at Broad and Liberty, Philadelphia Weekly, Newsmax contributor. I would definitely read his stuff. He's great. Hey, Ben, thanks for coming on.
Hey, Happy New Year, Chris. Man, you really threw me into the deep end here. It's like an obit. I don't know if I can live up to this intro.
That's what George McKenna said. I'm praising my friends over here, and all of a sudden it's like, you know.
And you brought me into Motley Crue, so I'm fired up. You know, I'm either going to do an exotic dance or we're going to get to the bottom of this issue today.
We're going to get to the bottom of this issue, and I can't think of anyone better than you. So what's up with this Krasner? I mean, it just, like, where to start?
So I'm glad we got a little time to talk about it today, because I want to get into not just the problem, which I think everyone with a pulse who's listening to these airwaves in the greater Delaware Valley knows the problem. I mean, starting with the fact that this morning, Philadelphia police was reporting 549 official murders in the city this year. That is unclear whether the two at the Risque, you know, Club Risque in Wissanoming last night were added. That could be 551, not counting the S jobs. So that is not only breaking last year's record, that's breaking last year's record by 52 murders, which is more than the entire city of Seattle had last year, to put it in perspective. But listen, this issue is not just Krasner. Krasner is obviously the vehicle for this issue. But for 4 years, you are right, people like myself, Ralph Cipriano, Broad and Liberty, we have been sounding the alarm. We have sources within both the DA's office and the police department who provide us charging documents. And we write columns and put this stuff in the air. And when a vast number of murderers comes out to have had recent interactions with the criminal justice system for violent felonies, they could have been off the street. So So let's talk about some solutions that have been completely missed. Am I?
Ben, you still there?
Yeah, you cut out for a second.
Yeah, there was a little bit of a glitch over there, but now we hear you. You're good. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, so there's a lot of solutions that were completely missed in calling Krasner out and restricting the fact that Krasner has been allowed to run roughshod with his reckless and dangerous policies. And, you know, not only policies that are his belief, but policies that are arguably illegal. They violate Krasner's oath of office, but the general duty of care that, you know, victims should start, if they can't get someone with a bully pulpit to enforce the law in this city, they should start suing these people civilly so that maybe we could, you know, sue them out of office. But, you know, the people in this city have been presented with a false binary choice, whether it's, you know, the African-American community or just progressives who have been told it's either my way or, you know, a systemic pattern of racism in the Philadelphia Police Department and criminal justice system, which quite frankly has not been proven. It just does not exist. This is one of the most racially balanced police departments in America, statistically.
So,
you're comparing it to cities like Portland and San Francisco, where the police departments are 85-90% white.
Right. And they're using situations like the William Wallace situation where, you know, this mentally ill guy comes charging at people with a knife. And that's, you know, anytime a white cop kills a black perpetrator, there's some kind of racial angle there. And that's wrong. I mean, that's like a correlation without a connection, something along those lines. It's ridiculous to say that they go after, that they treat black defendants or black perpetrators, you know, rushing at them with knives any differently than they would a white perpetrator. It's just, it's outrageous. It's fiction.
100%. His name is Walter Wallace, and they did riot over Walter Wallace, who was mentally ill. He was called there by his family, and he was caught on video wielding a butcher's knife and advancing toward the officers.
Right.
I mean, there is no cleaner shooting in the history of shootings. But that to further this political objective, Krasner strung the investigation out and allowed the city to riot. But Jim Kenney and Daniel Outlaw have a just a big of responsibility in this matter for failing to use their bully pulpit. And, you know, let's look at some of the approaches that have completely been failed to, you know, be utilized by the Kenney and Outlaw world is, you know, against Krasner, as well as the state, because if the city just decides they do not want to uphold their duty of care to protect the citizens of the city, you know, Governor Wolf and Attorney General Shapiro, who is running for governor, have a responsibility under their oath of office to go after these people for failing to do so, and including the criminals. They have prosecutorial authority, and they don't. So why has this been allowed to occur? Why has no one looked at the actual corruption that's enabling it in this city? Let's leave the policy positions out of this. Everyone knows Krasner is a lunatic and has his view of things. And, you know, really George Soros' view of things, because there's 13 other DAs in this country with record crime rates who are basically parroting the same talking points, as an irony. But, you know, there's myriad of corruption scandals that sit currently within Krasner's office that Attorney General Shapiro, who actually has the authority to, the responsibility to investigate, has completely allowed to fester, to include the fact that Lamar Stewart still works at the DA's office and still has access to the take-home car with lights and sirens he's been using to illegally stop people, to include an FBI agent that he fled from when he was chased.
And Ralph Cipriano has been like a pit bull with these stories. He has not let go. So, I mean, I want to give him a plug too for bigtrial.net, which is amazing. You want information that you're not going to get at the Philadelphia Inquirer? Go there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Ralph's dogged. He's got great sources, and you can't hide from charging documents. You can't hide from 302s, which are FBI incident reports. You can't hide from police reports. These things are happening, whether Krasner wants to admit them or not. You heard that tape you started off the clip with. So why is anyone not looking at the corruption? My last three pieces between the weekly, if you look at the cover stories in the last week, Broad and Liberty, you know, we're not only looking at Doc and Heenan, but the fact that Kenyatta Johnson is still collecting a city paycheck and yep. holding his office.
Yep.
So is Heenan illegally because he's officially been convicted. And Krasner's going completely unmitigated because he is violated for the second time in a row campaign finance laws.
Yeah.
So where is the state oversight? Where is Josh Shapiro?
Oh, he's nowhere. And in the next, listen in the next segment, you're going to hear a little bit about Josh. But you're absolutely right, too. It's kind of like, you remember with Bill McSwain, who's running for, also for governor, when he mm-hmm. was the U.S. attorney, thank God he used the power of the feds, which is what Jennifer, a brilliant, brilliant woman. I'm so glad she's the U.S. attorney. Jennifer Arbiter Williams is also doing. I mean, she's charging federally those guys who carjacked Mary Gay Scanlon, which obviously it's a federal crime. But Krasner, I mean, there aren't enough people who are holding him to task. It shouldn't be the feds who are doing this. You're right. Shapiro should be having oversight here.
Yeah, and the federal workaround, and look, I'm going to give Bill McSwain complete credit for, identifying and using federal workarounds like Brady violations for guns and things like that to go after criminals, dangerous criminals that Krasner let back on the streets. Because anyone who has gone through the schooling and training that I have knows in the criminal justice system, if you don't intervene a cycle of criminality, it graduates to more serious crime. I don't care what Mary Gay Scanlon said about, oh, well, they made a mistake. She's already trying to let these guys off the hook for carjacking her. You don't just start with carjacking. You graduate from car theft.
Right.
And when you're unchecked, then you pick up a gun. And this is the thing. Next thing they're going to do is commit robbery, and then after that, murder. That is how this works.
Ben, I want to hold you.
I
want you for the whole half hour, but we have a break. Can you hold on through a commercial break for me?
100%.
Okay, cool. I've got the great Ben Manis online. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
Malakilikimaka is a thing to say on a bright Hawaiian Christmas day.
Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Listen live everywhere at 990theanswer.com.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. And we are in the middle of a great conversation with someone who really has some answers here, or at least is asking the right questions, and that happens to be my friend Ben Manis. Ben, you were just talking about, with respect to Larry Krasner, it's not just Krasner, it's the people surrounding him, it's his aiders, it's his abettors. Can we talk for a minute about Josh Shapiro? Because I'm really angry at a guy who is supposedly the attorney general for all of Pennsylvania, but is pandering to his own party, to the Democrats, and now wants to be governor of the state. What has he done or not done to help stem the flow of violence in Philadelphia and statewide?
I'm glad you mentioned that. So the most readily available remedy for this issue here in Philadelphia is state oversight. And by the way, it's not just Philly. Pittsburgh's going on to record murders, too, with Zapala, who's like a mini Krasner. So you have a situation in the state where these cities are rogue, and they're allowed to do whatever they want to do because of things like the Home Rule Charter, because of the fact that Shane Kramer, who runs the Ethics Board, as mentioned in my last piece for the Weekly, has absolutely no teeth. Based on the charter, I think Shane wants to do a good job. I just think they have absolutely no ability under the law to remove a chronic violator from office. So that's when the state is required, not maybe, not can, they're required to step in and enforce the law. And if you look at states like Florida, one of Larry Krasner's beta tests, when you look at Soros-funded DAs in smaller cities that had radical approaches, was a woman named Aramis Ayala, and she was in Orlando. And she did the same. She refused to prosecute a cop killer there using the death penalty because in Florida they have a capital offense statute. And, the governor, Ron DeSantis, came in and removed her from the case physically. So they have that authority. So there's two problems in Pennsylvania. One, it's built on good faith. The law here is very arcane in that, criminal justice systems rely on a good faith attorney general to provide oversight to independent counties, you know, whether they be DAs, sheriffs, law enforcement agencies. In the case here, we have a attorney general who doesn't really like the two DAs that are, you know, running around roughshod on their counties, Philly and Pittsburgh, but needs their voting bases because he's more a political animal,
yep,
a county executive turned AG who wants to run for governor,
absolutely,
than he is a lawman. So he's letting it all happen because he doesn't want that woke base to turn against him when he comes up against a real opponent next year.
Plus, he's not even a lawyer.
Like Barletta or McSwain.
I mean, not that he's not a lawyer. He is. He has a law degree. But he's never, as far as I know, he's never prosecuted a case. He's never tried a case. He was a county commissioner in Montgomery County. I mean, I don't even know if he ever clerked for a judge. I don't know what legal work this man has ever actually done.
Well, he was a civil lawyer who became a politician.
Yeah.
And the problem is, you know, look, there's a lot of people like that. But the issue is not that he's not qualified, like Krasner wasn't qualified. He spent his whole career in defense. You're not supposed to be a prosecutor. It's a different game completely. But he's a guy who just, you know, is letting this go. And you have to understand something about the attorney general's office. We look at them kind of as like a civil adjunct because we live in a city of the first class here in Philly. You know, there are jurisdictions throughout the Commonwealth that rely on the troopers and the attorney general agents to do even the most basic narcotics enforcement because they may have like a 4 or 5 member police department in their town. So this is a vital office that's completely misrun because the guy is more concerned about his next job than he is doing the job he's doing now. But, you know, this is a bigger issue. There are people building plans. Like now, you know, in full disclosure, I'm on Lou Barletta's public safety committee.
Mm-hmm.
And they recruited me on that committee because of my criminal justice reform experience.
Yeah.
But they're building plans that could create apolitical oversights because Pennsylvania systemically doesn't have it. There just is no, you know, independence of inspector generals. There is no special prosecutor that's an appointee.
Yeah.
And these are things we most desperately need to kind of finish the job. You know, if I may criticize a guy I respect in McSwain, you know, he was taken out of office before he had the job to do, which was prosecuting a person like Krasner. Not just prosecuting the criminals he's letting go, but bringing a corruption indictment against him.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Jennifer Williams is going to do it, but it needs to get done because it's 4 years worth of really egregious conflicts, corruption and ethics issues that we've been reporting publicly using public documents, and nobody has brought this guy to court yet.
It absolutely is. It goes well beyond his, you know, political philosophy. You can attack an attorney general, a district attorney, a public official because you disagree with their politics and their priorities. That's fine. What's wrong is what you're pointing out. When there are actual legal, illegal acts, violations, ethical violations, you know, just absolute campaign finance violations, and that this is being ignored, it's outrageous. And you made a great point. You know, I'm glad you mentioned what you mentioned about Barletta. We need apolitical individuals when we're dealing with criminal justice. Criminal justice is not a political partisan issue. I didn't support 99% of the things, of the social policies that Ed Rendell supported, but I loved him as district attorney because I think he was absolutely on target with, you know, his position, his ideas about the capital punishment, about, you know, gun control, such as it is. I mean, and he was a Democrat. Lynn Abraham, adore her, personal, deep personal friend. Don't agree with some of her social policies. Straight on as district attorney. So you're absolutely right. It's not a partisan issue.
The politicization of apolitical offices, you know, even though they're elected, is leading us here. And that's why I said it before. It's not just Krasner. Let me give an example of what's happening in the court system right now. We have elected judges, even the ones that want to hear cases. The elected sheriff, Rochelle Bilal, who has a myriad of corruption scandals in her past and shouldn't be sheriff. Well, she has a policy in the sheriff's office that they won't even go and pick up a prisoner at State Road and transport them to the CJC if that prisoner was on a cell block with a COVID positive person. So, I mean, look at this. They could be asymptomatic. They don't want the, you know, sheriff transporting these people for the 10-minute drive downtown.
Am I correct, really quickly? Do you know, is this correct that the federal prisoners who were released because of COVID concerns are not going to be rearrested or not going to be taken back into custody? I saw a story. I don't even remember where it came out of. But is do you know if that's true?
Yes, that is. That
My
is, it depends
God.
On the one. I mean, for the most part, though, I call it, you know, there's an example of one right now, a guy named Seth Williams, who the former DA, who really, you know, and look, he's written some pretty good things about how bad Krasner is. But let's not forget, this guy caused that vacuum with his corruption and it enabled this Krasner to come into office. Yeah, he is not finishing his full term in prison because of this. What they do is they shift you to a probation or house arrest. Because, you know, in the federal system, a lot of your listeners may not know this. There is no early release parole. For a federal prisoner, when you get sentenced to a certain amount of time, unless you're pardoned or somehow given clemency, you're in there for the long haul. And in this case, there's a lot of people because of that COVID excuse that got let out. But that's federally. Like Seth Williams, I'm not worried about him sticking a gun in anyone's face tonight. I am a lot more worried about the people in the city system who just aren't being charged or held. This man is against cash bail. And I'm talking to former bail commissioners and magistrates right now in my next piece who are going to shed light on just how egregious this is. Because what they're doing is they're going in a DA, you know, these cub DAs who either came from defense or were fresh out of law school and barely passed bar. And they're going in and not asking for high bail on a person who literally stuffed a gun in someone's face.
No, because they're completely beholden to Larry. We are really up against a clock. When is your new piece going to appear and where is it going to appear?
Oh, I'm still drafting, so give me a week or two. It's going to be in the weekly, so you know, once a week we come out. But read, folks, let me give a shameless plug. Read the Philadelphia Weekly, Broad and Liberty, and Big Trial. I'll plug Ralph. I love Ralph. And look heavily at the state candidates. I wish the city GOP would go and recruit a guy who had a namesake like a Richie Ross to run in 23. But the way we save this is by electing a guy like Barletta next year who's going to hold Krasner and Kenny's feet to the fire. So get out there and do your part.
Well, we certainly need a strong GOP candidate because God forbid if Fetterman or Shapiro get into office. Thanks, Ben. Great job.
Chris DeGaulle now. Mike Gallagher at 9 on Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer.
Welcome back. We saved the best for last. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. I said we saved the best for last. I'm really happy to invite in my friend, someone who for whom I have a great deal of respect, and someone who is married. I'm sure he won't be upset if I mention this. Married to one of my own legal heroes, and that would be Jennifer Arbiter Williams, who happens to be the U.S. Attorney of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. Her proud husband, who himself is a state rep, former federal prosecutor, and all-around great person, Craig Williams, is on the line with us. Craig, Happy New Year and a belated Merry Christmas. Thanks for
Merry Christmas,
showing
Christine.
Up.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm really happy to have you on for a variety of reasons. I don't know if you heard Ben Manis in the last segment. We were talking about crime in the city of Philadelphia, what needs to be done across the state. You are a representative of one of the most beautiful parts of Delaware County, the Chadsford area. And I think that all of us in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania have a huge stake in the upcoming elections, both for governor and for senator. And I wanted you to come on and talk, first of all, about what you're doing, what you've done, which is substantial, to be able to provide resources to Philadelphia to be able to combat this horrific crime wave that we're suffering, and that it's not just hitting Philadelphia, it's hitting us in Delaware County and bleeding over into the other counties. It's not just a Philly problem.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So as you said in the outset, I'm a former federal prosecutor with the Department of Justice, in addition to being a retired Marine colonel. And part of my job with the Department of Justice was to be a Project Safe Neighborhoods prosecutor. And what PSN was about was essentially getting prior convicted felons found in possession of guns off the street and given federal sentences. And as you know, being an attorney yourself, when you get a federal sentence, you serve every day of that time. There's no parole in the federal system. Right. And the federal system sentencing is also, it's very severe, especially for prior convicted felons, because your sentence is based on your criminal history. So that's an extremely effective tool at combating gun violence. And, you know, as I've talked to some of my colleagues in Philadelphia, my House of Representative colleagues, that's their biggest complaint, is that there is no sense in the streets of Philadelphia right now that there's going to be any retribution for crime, as we just saw with the carjacking of Congresswoman Scanlon. And so this idea of Project Safe Neighborhoods, the federal government getting involved, is what gave me the idea to have an appropriation from the state to hire more prosecutors in Delaware County and in Philadelphia to be federalized special assistant U.S. attorneys at the Department of Justice. So in essence, those two district attorney offices would hire more prosecutors, and they would work for the federal government on their behalf, which is a program that already exists. Mm-hmm. And I was able to get $1.5 million from the state budget to help that out, which in our calculation is about 10 more prosecutors. And a typical gun prosecutor, I handled anywhere from 50 to 75 cases a year. That's hundreds of felons in possession of firearms off the streets of Philadelphia and Delaware County.
Craig, that's amazing. And you're talking about, you're actually that, as you said, federal, you a federal crime, you do the time. There's no parole, there's no early release. And that's really serious stuff. So you're actually providing, you know, excuse the pun, weapons to these prosecutors' offices, the state prosecutors. Have they done anything with this? Has Stolzheimer in Delaware County or Krasner, have the funds been provided to prosecutors across the state or just in our particular area in the Delaware Valley?
So I wrote the legislation, and I set it up as a pilot for Delaware County and for Philadelphia.
Great.
So that we could prove its effectiveness. We let both the district attorney in Philadelphia know about it and the district attorney in Delaware County know about it by way of letter back in September, after me having a phone call with Jack Stolzheimer. And to date, we haven't spent the first dollar. I've gone to the floor of the House twice to speak about it. I've gone to my colleagues, especially in Philadelphia, to try to get a meeting with Krasner about it. And I've just seen no movement. And that's not to say that they haven't been, you know, exercising their own due diligence in the backdrop. But, you know, I've asked for communication and have gotten none returned. Now,
Why do you think that is?
I just want to add that, you know, Jack Stolzheimer and I have had a productive conversation and relationship. So I think this is predominantly about Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And I think with regard to Philadelphia, it's a mentality. Yeah. It's a prosecutorial mentality.
And I want to interject here, too, as well. I've had a conversation with Jack Stolzheimer here on the air. I've spoken with him. I find him to be a good man. I think Delaware County is fortunate in him. He is not in the mold of Larry Krasner. So I would agree with you on that point, you know, with that caveat. Still, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, why aren't they using the money you've provided them with?
I think Delaware County is procedural. We've got to ask the Delaware County Council for permission to hire new prosecutors there. Jack has asked me to wait until the new year, and I've respected that. On the Philadelphia side, I think it's a mindset about avoiding prosecution. I mean, Larry Krasner has prided himself on emptying the jails by 40%.
Yeah.
Well, each one of those felons is now prohibited by federal law from owning a gun, possessing a gun, or possessing ammunition. And that's the tool right there. And he views gun possession as being, as to use his words in the press, simple possession cases. Which he equates to simple possession of drugs. And he thinks that people ought not be prosecuted for simply possessing a gun if they haven't done anything with it.
Oh. So actually, Larry supports, he's a big NRA Second Amendment supporter, right?
Right.
It's crazy. But doesn't it also seem, and, you know, I understand where you're coming from, and I'm coming from the same place, but doesn't it seem that Krasner has an adversarial position, a posture with respect to the U.S. Attorney's Office, the federal government, unlike other prosecutors in the past who had a more holistic view of law enforcement? You know, they tried to work side by side with their federal partners. It seems that Krasner is in opposition to them. You know, his old defense lawyer days, he's just never taken off that mantle. He's not a prosecutor.
I don't know that I can speak to his relationship with the U.S. Attorney's Office now. I know it was adversarial with the prior U.S. Attorney, but I think that's just him by nature, that he's got the progressive view of prosecution, which is it ought to hurt you a little bit when you prosecute a criminal. We just saw the article in the newspaper in the last week about the mass exodus of assistant district attorneys, and one of them was quoted as saying that there were actual ADAs in the office hired by him who were in tears when they convicted somebody. I'm like, if that's your view of prosecutorial life, then you're in the wrong job. You know, having been a prosecutor at the Department of Justice and then also, you know, the head prosecutor of the entire Marine Corps Reserve, I can tell you that the mindset has to be about keeping people safe. And you know, we've got an issue there also with the Attorney General, who,
yes,
when asked about violence in Philadelphia, goes to a microphone and blames the Republican General Assembly every time he has an opportunity. Well, you know, we've passed tens of millions of dollars worth of appropriations for the Attorney General's office to have a violence task force, a gun violence task force, to be funded to do things in Philadelphia. And in 2019, passed Act 58, which gave him concurrent jurisdiction to come into Philadelphia to prosecute gun crimes. So he likes to have videos of him shooting a basketball, because I guess he was a basketball player in high school. He did nothing with Act 58, which is the equivalent of handing him the ball, sending him to the free throw line, and him standing there and doing nothing with it. And the reason for that,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, the reason for that is because the progressives in the city and Larry Krasner said that is not their style of prosecution, that they're not going to be going after simple possession cases. And they said, you will not be doing it. And he healed. He absolutely healed.
You know, you and Representative Martina White and a very few others have really have tried to do something significant with respect to the crime problem. And as you were just talking about, the legislation that was passed that basically gave a golden key to, you know, for another image there, another metaphor, to the attorney general. Now, you're a politician. You were a federal prosecutor. You're an attorney. You're someone who understands law enforcement. You come from this from a very honest place. But you're a politician right now. You had to run for office. He also had to run for office. But the position of the attorney general is not a political office. It shouldn't be a partisan political office. And that's the way it seems that Josh Shapiro is running that office. As you said, he doesn't want to ruffle the feathers of a Larry Krasner, of the political base that Larry Krasner represents. So how can the legislature, I mean, what powers do you have to force him to do something? I know it's a co-equal branch of government, but what can you do to force him to use the tools that you've given him to protect us, the people who, well, I didn't vote for him, but the people who elected him?
Well, I think we can continue to give him that authority, which is what Representative White and I intend to do when we go back into session in January. We are going to offer a bill that reauthorizes Act 58 to give Josh Shapiro concurrent jurisdiction in Philadelphia, and we'll see if he uses it. And I agree with you. You know, I think many of us, just like Jack Stoltzheimer, we know Josh Shapiro. and we know him to be an amiable, likable guy, and he tends to treat people well, except in this last year when he started running for governor, and everything turned hyper-partisan. If you watch his social media feed, it is entirely about turning half of the state on the other half of the state and making sure that there's this constant divide, this constant feuding back and forth, this constant tribalism. And I believe that comes from watching Fetterman do it online, because he's particularly effective at it. He's created this online personality that is constantly pitting one side against the other. And I believe that Josh believes that that's the way he's going to win election for governor. And as a consequence, he's taken off his law enforcement mantle and adopted one as a running candidate. And that's unfortunate for all of us who actually care about law enforcement.
Well, that's exactly right. And I had mentioned to the last guest, to Ben Manis, that I didn't agree with a lot of the social policies of Ed Rendell, but I respected him deeply and profoundly as a prosecutor. Doesn't matter that he was a Democrat. I happened to be a registered Democrat at the time when he was in office as well. But it really, you know, law enforcement is one of the areas where politics really shouldn't have any impact. And I mean, I look at you, I look at Representative White. There are very few Democrats that I see in the state legislature that, you know, sort of rise above that as well. There are a few. Off the top of my head, I can't name any, but it really seems as if this has become a game anymore. And it's interesting that you mentioned that Shapiro in the last year has pivoted. It's not authentic, because it's not the Josh Shapiro that we've known for the last, you know, however many years he was a Montgomery County commissioner and then Attorney General. I disagreed with his positions on so many things when he sued the Little Sisters of the Poor and what have you. But it really seems that in the last year, he's abandoned that mantle of being the chief law enforcement officer, and now he's, you know, wannabe governor. We have to take a quick break, but I would love to hold you over for a couple of minutes after the break to talk about redistricting. Can you do that for me? Can you hold off for a
little bit?
Absolutely. Thanks, Craig.
Absolutely.
That's State Rep Craig Williams, and we will be right back. This is Christine Flowers on Philadelphia's 990 AM, The Answer.
News, opinion, passion. Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. I'm having a great conversation with a friend and just a fantastic public servant, and that would be State Rep. Craig Williams. Craig, I'm looking at the television over here. This is absolutely apropos to nothing, but I'm looking at, I don't know if it's ESPN or what, it's on the screen, and it says, are the Steelers the best destination for Aaron Rodgers? Can I get your opinion on that? Do you think Aaron Rodgers should go to the Steelers? I don't know, just like a random thought over here. I'm looking, oh my God, Aaron Rodgers.
Random. I don't know. He's had an unusual year, although I think he's got the pack in a good spot, but I don't know. I think that might be good for the Steelers. I wouldn't mind having him in Pennsylvania. That would be quite a story.
That's what I was hoping you would say. Anyway,
yeah.
So let's talk about Pennsylvania and the wonderful the games that people play in Pennsylvania, redistricting, sort of preordaining who is going to be able to keep their seats in federal and state and local office. So what's going on there? What are they doing? What's the dairying doing that's happening? Who's redrawing those maps to determine who's going to be my representative?
So great question. As you probably know, that there are two different processes for your congressional maps and then your state House and Senate maps. On the federal side, for your congressional maps, which by the way have to be drawn this year, Christine, because we lost a congressional seat, so we can't possibly move forward with an election in 2022 without having a new map. That process goes through normal legislation. So
The map originates in the state government committee, and then it moves through the House and the Senate, just like any piece of legislation to be signed by the governor. And then there's an automatic right of appeal to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And then, as you know, with the case involving, you know, Goofy kicking Donald, and I think we Republicans have to just own the fact that that map was flat out embarrassing.
Yeah.
But the Supreme Court struck down the next map that came out and then issued their own. So that's the current worry, is that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has already established for itself precedent that they can just draw the map themselves, which of course isn't substantiated by either the federal or the Pennsylvania Constitution.
Yeah, I think that violates the Constitution. And I mean, but the Supreme Court kind of batted that down, didn't they? The Supreme Court of the United States, basically, they didn't take that case.
They didn't. And you know, as you and I both know, the fact that they did not grant certiorari is not a judgment on the facts.
Right.
But it is a bit concerning that in a moment when a state Supreme Court drew the congressional maps and the U.S. Constitution is clear about the fact that that's in the purview of the state legislature, that is concerning. And I think that you know, the people that are on the bench right now for the Pennsylvania Supreme Court have to feel that that's a bit empowering.
Yep.
Shifting over to the state map, that's a completely different process. The state constitution calls for the Legislative Reapportionment Commission, which is five people. It's the minority leader and the majority leader of the House, so that's a Republican and a Democrat, the minority and the majority leader of the Senate, a Republican and a Democrat, and then a fifth neutral chairperson who's supposed to basically mediate between those four parties. If those four people can't decide on a chairperson, then it's the Pennsylvania Supreme Court who decides who that is. And in this instance, they did not decide the four members of the commission. So it went to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and they picked Mark Nordenberg, the former chancellor of Pitt, who himself has been a Biden donor, who was on
Great.
The Wolf transition team.
Nice neutral person.
Right. And The Senate, to their great credit, got to work. They were collaborating on the majority and minority side. That work did not happen in the House. There was a breakdown in communication, and Nordenberg took that as an opportunity to draft his own maps. And it's clear that his objective was to flip the House.
Oh, man. And so Biden basically drew our maps. I mean, yeah, I know. It's a little bit of hyperbole seriously.
And bear in mind, this man's an academic. So, you know, he's more concerned about legacy than just about anything else in the world. Nothing would make him happier than to have a Pennsylvania Supreme Court case with his name in the caption. That he changed the law of Pennsylvania. So for him, the political outcome is everything. He believes that we're in a 50-50 state based only on the presidential election, and therefore we ought to have a 50-50 House.
That's crazy.
The Princeton gerrymandering project ran 1 million sample maps through their computers and came to the conclusion that the natural political geography of Pennsylvania is 110 Republican seats. Right now we sit at 113, so it's very close to its natural geography.
That's crazy. Craig, I hear the music. It's gone. You know what? Can you come back tomorrow? Can you come on tomorrow and continue? Because I want to continue this conversation. I'll give you a call and we'll figure out a time. You're the best. You're great. We're up against the clock. I hate the clocks.
It's Mike Gallagher. Join me this morning at 9 on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Now let's get you back to Philadelphia's Morning Answer with the great Chris DeGaulle.
Gotta run. Want to thank everybody, including and most especially Eddie, Chris, George, Ben, Craig.
This is WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. A Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn.
deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.